And y'all can see that from back there? Okay? Kind of. Phase out, sleep. All right. We'll give a few more minutes. I think we still have a few more minutes before we get going. I'll try to record it on this little audio thing. If mine screws up, I'll go to yours and ask you to download it. That way you can go back to it. Hopefully you found the web page already, and up there is your PowerPoints. I updated a few little things, and I'll try to get this Echo 360, or at least this audio up there, right after class, too. So I noticed that some of you, I recognize some of you from Bio 350, right? But some of you, has anybody not taken Bio 350 before? A couple of you haven't? Okay. That's animal physiology class. So when I looked at the PowerPoints that Dr. Debski sent me, I said, well, we covered a lot of this in Bio 350, so I knew it would be a review for some of you. But for others that haven't had it, we'll definitely want to make sure we're all the same page. And it's always a good review in case we forgot over the winter break or over the summer, right? All right, so I think this is probably your full class, isn't it, pretty much? Are you missing anybody that you know of? Maybe one or two, too cold out today, all right? Okay, well, I'm Robin Cooper, and I've been at UK for about 18 years. So, old hat. Every once in a while, I'll fill in for whatever it takes in classes. And so I teach animal physiology, Bio 350, and some of you are recognized from that. And some of this will be, as I mentioned, a review, but I want to definitely have anybody to stop if there's anything that we didn't cover clearly. All right, so let me start this thing, and then I think this will capture everything that's on the computer screen, so that's what I'm hoping. All right, so you left off talking about neurons before, I guess, right? And a little bit about how electrical activity travels down a neuron. Yes? All right. So we want to talk about that wrapping that goes around the neuron. And you probably just started with that, right? The insulation that's around that. And it's much like wires. What would happen if you had an electrical wire, you know, like to your lamp and at your home, right? You usually have two wires, you know, the electrical outlet. If you only have the two prongs, you got those two wires. What if you took that insulation off and you crossed those two wires? What's going to happen? Spark, it's going to short out, right? It's very much the same idea if you have two neurons next to each other and one's firing here and there's no insulation in between, it's going to affect the other one. So the idea is to have some insulation between those because it's carrying electrical activity. So you can basically like short out the other neuron. And so let's just back up a little bit before we get into some of these components of myelination. Remember the action potential? Did you cover that in here again probably a bit, right? So sodium goes in, right? What comes out of the cell for the action potential? Potassium, right? And it depends on the cell. It might even be some calcium that's going into the neuron as well, right? And then that brings, so the sodium goes in, it depolarizes, goes to the peak. Sodium channels inactivate, right? Potassium channels are opening, so it comes back down, right? Everybody's on the same page. And then you might go back to resting membrane potential. Depends if it's a cycling neuron or not. What happens to that potassium that comes out of that neuron? Now it was inside the neuron. Now it's outside. And that potassium, what's it going to do?
Does it passively go back into the cell?
So the idea is that, does it passively go back in? That's an interesting point.
And ATP pump.
ATP pump. So the concentration's still very high inside the cell compared to outside. So it would be against a concentration gradient, but favoring the electrical gradient. But it just came out. But the main idea is the pump. The pump really helps to reestablish that equilibrium again. But what if you had two neurons next to each other, and that potassium, and you fired this one neuron, so like two, you know, here's your two fingers. This one's firing all the time. Action potential is going down just repetitively all the time, right? And that potassium's coming out into that space, the extracellular space. What's going to happen to that neighboring neuron that might be inactive? What does potassium do if you raise potassium outside of a cell? If you took an intracellular electrode and you stabbed it inside of a muscle cell or a neuron or any cell in your body and you raise the potassium outside in the bathing solution, what would happen to your membrane potential? And let's see, your clinically dressed. Are you in nursing or?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So do you remember your potassium concentrations for the blood? Not yet. Okay, you'll have to have that down pat. It'll be one of those tattoos that you'll make on your hand for a test. Potassium is very tightly regulated in us. Otherwise, we have arrhythmias, and our neurons go haywire, and our muscles will start twitching as well. So potassium is tightly regulated. But the idea is, if you raise potassium, it's a classic experiment that we do in like animal physiology lab, and it's been done back in the 1950s. If you raise potassium outside the cell, your resting membrane potential goes up. It depolarizes. Great point. So now, go back to those two neurons. This one's firing all the time over here on the left-hand side. And the potassium's spilling out here in the extracellular fluid. If that potassium, could it influence the other cell? What would happen to the cell? This depolarizes. If this depolarizes, it changes its electrical properties. So that's called ephaptic transmission, actually, ephaptic transmission. And people believe that this can happen in our spinal cord and with high activity. In demyelinating diseases, when you take away that insulation, think what happens. You have activity in one neuron, and that spillage, if it's high activity, can actually influence the neighboring cells. So it's interesting of why you probably have that wrapping around these axon paths that can be highly active, and that helps to protect that environment to keep it stable. And so glial cells, or these cells around those neurons, can actually help to take up the potassium and buffer it. And also, like Ellen was saying, the sodium-potassium pump in the neuron itself will help to bring that potassium back into the cell and re-establish equilibrium again. All right? So the idea is that you get the ideas of how important this insulation is, this myelination. Other things that are very interesting that Dr. Debski had in her slides here is that the myelin components, the central and peripheral myelin, they contain this protein called myelin basic proteins. These are proteins that are inside of the bilipid membrane. You know, so the bilipid membrane, remember back to cell your cell biology, the bilipids? There's proteins inside that bilipid membrane. And one of these proteins, or a family of them, are called these myelin basic proteins. And they are interdigitated inside of that bilipid membrane. Well, these proteins are very important. If they don't have these proteins, the myelin doesn't form right around the neurons. So they found out that there's a number of these from a single gene, and it's alternately spliced. So you know a gene, and then it's spliced to make these different types of proteins, these myelin basic proteins. The point here is that they're highly antigenetic. So if you inject these into an animal, like if you took human myelin basic proteins and injected it into a mouse, it would probably develop antibodies to the human form, right? But also, what's the disease that happens in humans then where you might have your own autoimmune disease where you start breaking down your own myelin?
MS,
right. So you can start to break down your own myelin, fighting your own body against that. And it's really a very debilitating disease. And you usually probably will die from it if you have it. So it's important to think about. And you can inject that into animals, and they get this what's called an experimental allergenic encephalitis, and it demyelinates the CNS. MS is primarily in the central nervous system where you start to see the defects with the scanning types of MRIs that you can actually see the demyelination occurring. And then you can think about what would happen with those neurons next to each other if they're not having that buffer system. Right. Do you have enough chairs? Do you want to sit up here? I won't bite, I promise. Here you go. Here's this chair right here. Come on. Okay, so interesting to think about what can happen. And then just to kind of refresh our memory here, what is this formed from? In the CNS, oligodendrocytes make these wrappings, right? And in the periphery, in the peripheral nervous system, they're from Schwann cells. Sorry, it's at the bottom of your slide here. But Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system to make these wrappings, and oligodendrocytes in the CNS. And these are these myelin sheaths. And in some neurons, they might be many, many wrappings, and others not as many. But in general, you get the idea. And the regions between
these wrappings are called nodes around VA. And you might remember this in maybe even Bio 152. This is where your sodium channels are highly aggregated to rejuvenate an action potential as it travels down the axon. But you get the idea of this insulation, multiple wrappings around there. So very protected environment. And one of these oligodendrocytes might actually go around several axons. Right? So this one oligodendrocyte might be wrapping around this and wrapping around the others. Actually, you know, inside of a nerve, this oligodendrocyte probably is wrapping all around many of these together to keep them isolated from each other. So very important cells. And you can kind of see a little blown up here of the axon and these nodes around VA. If you're thinking of a full tract that's wrapped all the way around, like in the central nervous system in short distances, this wrapping is important to keep that potassium balance, right? So it doesn't go out in here, but also other cells' activity not influencing this cell. There's a little space in here, actually, and that little space can raise up in potassium, but with the sodium-potassium pump can bring that potassium right back down and reestablish equilibrium back in the axon. Okay, so what they found is they can develop a mouse. This is called shiver mutation, because shivering is just a recessive mutation. And so they've deleted some of the exons in this region for making the myelin basic protein, and they found out that this can cause tremors in these mice. So they shake. That's the idea of the shivering. So they shiver, they shake, and they can die very early in their development. What's interesting is that they found out about, in these homozygous types of these mice, about 10% of normal myelination. So the 90% is gone, right? Only about 10% remaining. If they take the gene in those mice and try to repair it by injecting the correct gene in these mice, then inject the gene into these fertilized eggs, and now that mutant mouse is making the appropriate protein, and guess what? It produces about 20% of the normal amount of protein, so, and they get a lot more myelination around the axons. So that this myelin basic protein is very important for helping with that whole process of myelination. And it seems like these mice can live, have a normal lifespan, and their tremors are reduced. So that little bit of reduction in myelination, or enhancing that myelination from 10% to 20%, can really be beneficial for protecting the nervous system. So you get the idea of how important this is. And if anybody knows anybody with MS, you know that that's a very debilitating disease for them, and they might have problems. When do they generally have a lot of problems, a person with MS? Winter, summer, exertion if they're moving around, or when they're sleeping, relaxed. It's usually when they're active, right? And you think about, it's probably with this activity or stress. And it's not probably, it's a complex disorder, so it's probably just not only the nervous system problem, but you know, other problems that are occurring with the long-term chronic problems that they have. All right, so you get the idea of how important that is with the myelination. What's also very interesting about that whole tube that's made for the axon is it's very interesting because you can take out like the sciatic nerve from a frog or a mouse, take it out, put it in a dish, and the neuron will die, but it leaves a basal lamina, kind of an outline of where the nerve was when that neuron was. And now you got like a little sheath that you can work with. And that little sheath is phenomenal because you can take that and actually use that to grow neurons on. And people have really found some really fascinating aspects with this. So in our peripheral nerves, in case you might not know, if you cut your arm, say by an accident, your nerves will grow about a millimeter a day. About 24 hours, it'll grow a millimeter. So the idea is that if you have a peripheral nerve cut, you could have your nerve regrow back to the right spot. But the problem is if it's cut up here, how does that motor nerve grow back to the right muscles, right? So the idea is the direction. You know, you just don't want it regrowing. How is it going to find that muscle again? Because how did it start off to know the right muscle? Any ideas? How did that motor nerve get to that right muscle in your finger to begin with?
They innervated by like multiple ones, and then they switched to just being innervated by one.
Exactly. But think about, when does that happen? Good point.
When you grow.
Yeah, when you're developing. So you think about those muscle cells developing, and we don't have an embryology course here. Embryology is a great course to take. If you ever get a chance, EKU offers an embryology course. I didn't say that on UK. Okay, but embryology is a great course. If you think of these somites, you actually have muscle groups of muscles on the side of your body when you're developing called somites, and they're with every segment in your body. And those somites develop into your muscles. And when those somites start to migrate and make muscles for your segmental body or even your hands and feet, the motor neurons grow towards those. So they're connecting in, like you're saying, they're connecting in, they grow to that region, and then they have to battle it out to find out which ones are going to be the stable ones there. But now, as an adult, here your muscles are way out here, and where's the cell body for that motor neuron? Inside your ventral nerve cord, right? In your spinal cord, on the ventral side. So, as an adult, it's hard to know where that target is, because when it first grew, it was growing with the muscle, and it was being pulled out and growing along as that muscle's migrating to form your muscles in your finger. But as an adult, now it's where it's lost its communication, right? So the idea is to try to direct these cut nerves back in the right track again, and then see if they'll either grow along where the old nerve was, or maybe you have to do something to encourage it to keep getting there, right? The idea is then also your sensory nerves. What happened to those? You cut these off. Where's the cell body for your sensory nerves in your arm? Are the cell bodies out here in my finger? Let's say pinch. You know, you pinch your finger right here, right? Ouch. Where's the cell body for that neuron?
Is it?
It's, what do we call that? It's close to the spinal cord. Dorsal root ganglion. These are the ganglion that are outside the spinal cord, and they're right outside your vertebrae, and that's where the cell body is. So that's a long axon out here, and the sensory endings out in your skin. So if you cut that, well, now you have to have really the sensory neuron to regrow this direction back out to that skin again, too, right? So that's the way it's, what's going to happen on that point. And your motor neuron has to grow back out to, say, the muscles. But about a millimeter a day. Why is it that the peripheral nervous system, if you cut that, that can grow? The problem is getting it directed. But if you damage your neurons in your brain or in your spinal cord, you cut a track there, the neurons don't like to grow. They'll just stay there, and they don't sprout out, and they won't grow. What's so different about this nerve than a nerve that's in your spinal cord or in your brain? I mean, up higher centers. And so that was a mystery for many years. And wondering, what is it? Well, maybe it has something to do with that environment that's around that nerve in the periphery and the environment that's around the nerves in your central nervous system, in your spinal cord or in your higher brain. So people began to question that. And one approach to do that is to take that, like we said, that sciatic nerve out, put it in a dish, and make little cuts in the spinal cord, for example, and insert that nerve bundle that you used to have. The nerve died out, but you have the basal lamina there, and then they could find neurons that would sprout inside of a cut spinal cord. Phenomenal. So anyways, coming back to that, then, if you took out a peripheral nerve, you know, the myelin's going to break down, the axon's break down, but you have that basal lamina that's still there, this tubular-like structure, so a little tube. And the idea is that's just phenomenal when this was found out, because maybe you could direct cut nerves high up on someone's arm with that, and especially if you could grow these in culture and then have certain sizes that you could use. Or maybe even donors from people, right? A lot of tissue is donated from cadavers. You might find that pretty gross, but a lot of collagen, people inject collagen in their bodies, right, to either rebuild something or whatever. That collagen a lot of times comes from cadavers. And so cadavers are utilized quite a bit. Skin for burn victims. Sometimes they take that off a person that just died. If they donated their body, they'll remove patches of skin and use that for burn victims. And you've probably heard of corneal transplants and lots of different things that are used. But also think about the abilities, maybe taking out basal lamina and culturing it if you keep it alive, and maybe using that for people with injuries. Be an interesting concept, but I haven't heard of that happening yet with cadavers. They're trying to build matrix that to allow neurons to grow on a matrix, which is really quite interesting. All right, so these Schwann cells, remember the Schwann cells are the peripheral ones, right? Oligodendrocytes are the ones in the CNS. So Schwann cells secrete something that's very interesting. They secrete these growth factors, and they promote the neurons to grow. And so that's really neat. And so I put this PDF online for you because this is so interesting. Let's see if this comes up. If it doesn't, I have to do a server thing or something. But when you click on that, you'll find this PDF that's really amazing. And this came from Albert Aguayo. I think he was originally from Argentina. And he did some phenomenal work. He works up in Canada. And he did these experiments where he took out the peripheral nerve of, say, a mouse or another organism, a rat, and he found out some really neat aspects. He could cut the optic nerve in the back of that mouse or that rat, and your optic nerve has about 1 million neurons in it. And he could take that sciatic nerve, the neuron dies out, right, so you got this tube, and put it in the back of the eye, and then either have it go underneath the skull and back into the optic tectum, or region where the, depending on the animal, back where those projections go to inside of that animal, inside of that mouse or that rat. And those neurons would grow in that track and actually innervate the target that the neurons normally innervate. And so when he shined light on the eye, he would actually see those second-order neurons become activated. Wow. I mean, that's phenomenal. And it was all from these kind of tracks. He should get a Nobel Prize. He really should. He has neurosurgeons working with him, computational people trying to figure out ideas of matrix forming and lots of neat things. So he's a phenomenal person. And he wrote this chapter if you wanted to look it up. And he even shows tracks, partly with that optic nerve tracks and some other experiments that he did. And it's a history of this whole phenomenon of using these donor peripheral nerves. So quite phenomenal. But what? Why is it then the CNS doesn't grow? And this is really an issue. Actually, when they found some factors in the CNS, and this is kind of older literature now, but and it's not in your PowerPoint notes, but a guy in Zurich, Switzerland, Martin Schwab, he gave a talk here not too long ago in Louisville. He found factors called inhibitory factor 1 and inhibitory factor 2 that were inside of the mouse brain. When they cut the nerves, they couldn't get growth. But if he had antibodies to these inhibitory factors and used the antibodies to then block those inhibitory factors, those neurons would start sprouting. That was just revolutionary. Very phenomenal, you know, that there's some inhibitory factor in our brain, in our central nervous system, that keeps neurons from growing. So that really stimulated a lot more understanding about what are these oligodendrocytes maybe secreting that don't allow neurons to grow, that are inhibiting neuron outgrowth. When you kind of think about this, why do you think you might promote a peripheral nerve to grow but not a central neuron or one in our spinal cord?
Could it be like cancerous? If you like have a lot of good growth factors in there and like it grows, it can overgrow and form like tumors and stuff?
It could be, definitely. Maybe the tumor idea would be interesting to think about. Tumors are usually like the cell division, right, and then increasing cell numbers. But maybe the idea is right where you're going, is if you promoted neurite outgrowth in a very complex network, like in our brain for thinking, on our spinal cord, where you have a lot of integration, think how tightly regulated that needs to be. And if you just had kind of sprouting and back and forth, it might be, maybe it's just too complex. You know, who knows really why that is that way, but it is. And maybe that's part of a rationale for it. But anyways, here on this slide, this is the same idea that could be used. You could cut a spinal cord and take a peripheral nerve and actually put that across the cut, right? Say in a mouse, much like what we just talked about with the optic nerve, with the sciatic nerve. And the idea is to hopefully get the track back online again, and maybe they would connect back up and have, you know, a pattern where they could go across that injury site. One of the biggest problems with any neural cut or injury in the brain and our spinal cord or even out in our periphery is this glial scar that can form, and it doesn't allow the neurons to go past that. And you can, if you cut a nerve in your peripheral arm, you can get what's called like a glioma. The nerve will grow, and it's trying to grow, but that scar tissue keeps it from growing, so it builds like a little ball right there, and it's very sensitive if you touch it. You can imagine the sensory endings are all right there if it makes the sensory endings for pain or touch. So you have to get that neuron to grow out of that little injury site. So this is quite interesting when you think about what people are doing. There's so many different things out there that people are starting to develop to try to correct these injury problems. And then you think about what's causing these problems. And as we mentioned, this is the idea of maybe blocking these inhibitory factors. So if you do anything that inhibits this myelin, you might, these inhibitory factors, you might then promote repair and regeneration. And the idea is to maybe treat animals with this type and have them be able to continue to grow, say, those motor neurons or those connections back in the spinal cord from an injury and actually get movements back. But as I mentioned, it's very complex, right, of being able to do all this. So people have found these particular molecules and trying to remove this myelin from damaged spinal cords. And if you remove the myelin from the damaged spinal cord, what have you removed? The key is the molecules that they make, right? These inhibitory molecules. So then you might be able to get the neurons to then grow if you take away this inhibition. I hear it beeping sound. We had a fire alarm earlier this morning. Hopefully we won't get another one. So they've identified some specific proteins that are inside of the CNS that are inhibiting growth. And some of these have names, and I put the names down here in your PowerPoint for you. These myelin-associated glycoproteins. So these are proteins in that myelin sheath, coming out of the bilipid membrane. It's glycoproteins. And then the receptor that's referred to here as NGR. This is this no-go 66 receptor. These are receptors that are on the neurons that sensitive to these inhibitory factors. So what do you think you could do if you've identified the receptor for an inhibitory factor and you've identified some of the inhibitory factors? NIH wants to give you $1 million now, so what kind of experiments do you think you'd want to perform? If you know some of this information here, the factors that are made, and you got the receptors that they're responsible to bind it to. Right. Block the receptors. Yeah, use something that you could block them with, some kind of antagonist, right, that you could block those receptors, and maybe then you could then have the neuron to grow, something that won't stimulate those receptors, right? Or maybe make something that wouldn't even make the receptors at all. If you could use some kind of, think about how people are using viruses today. Viruses can, you could inject these into your nervous system, and those viruses, they can get inside your neurons, and then the DNA is incorporated, and they can make things, right? So you can use viruses to target, to make proteins that maybe are absent. Well, what if you made a virus that might make an messenger RNA, but an inhibitory messenger RNA, right? One that's messed up, and it competes with the messenger RNA that's normally inside the cell, right? Are we all following? Right. Okay, so you have the proteins that are normally made in the cell from a messenger RNA. But if you had a virus to maybe inject the right sequence inside of this cell, you could make a messenger that will block the messenger RNA that's normally being made, and then you won't make that receptor. So then you won't have the inhibitory response inside the cell. There's lots of neat things that are going on with viruses and virus technology to try to correct defects inside of cells. So you could actually think of maybe a way to block that receptor, or maybe destroy the myelin that's making these inhibitory factors. But we also know that there's a problem with disturbing the myelin, that if you're not making myelin, what's happening too? You're short-wiring the neurons. Maybe after the repair, or if it can get across that injury site, let the myelin, go back again, right? So some interesting aspects with this. All right. And they do know then if this myelin-associated glycoprotein are no-gro, the other compound that binds to these receptors, if they are capable of causing these neurite, these growth cones in the neurite to actually fall down and collapse, so they won't continue to grow. And here's some nice slides that Dr. Debski had. Might be a little hard to see here, but you see this one that's all branched out. This is normal neuron that's in culture and could just be growing all over the place. And then you look at this neuron that's treated with no-go, and it can't grow at all, right? So if you put that inhibitory factor on, it stops the growth cone from growing out. And if you could take that away, then neurons will continue to grow. So the point here is that they've able to find these specific molecules that are responsible for inhibiting the central neurons from growing. And some of those are these myelin basic type of proteins that we've talked about that are responsible for making myelin that are important. But the other two that we just mentioned, this MAG, myelin-associated glycoprotein, and this NOGO itself, and then its receptor. So you think about these all working together. All right. Fascinating aspects. And I think I put I had a paper here. Let's see, where is that? That was the CNS repair. Oh, somewhere I have a paper. I think I put it on the website about a paper that is actually describing some of these receptors that you can look up, and it's kind of neat study. A little older paper. Okay, so let's think about the nervous system in general and kind of make sure we're all on the same page and understanding these parts. This is what Dr. Debski wanted me to go over, the parts of the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, because you're going to be jumping into more about these details later on. So what is it that we normally think of the central nervous system? The brain, the spinal cord as well, and the retina, because the retina is very complex. It's like a little brain itself, right? All those layers of neurons that are in the back of the retina, they consider that as pretty much a central nervous system. And the peripheral nervous system, everything outside of the brain and the spinal cord. But this kind of gets a little bit complicated sometimes, right? Where's the cell body for your motor neurons? It's inside your spinal cord, right? And everybody knows the structure. If you had a cross-section of the spinal cord, could you tell me what's in... Let's go draw back here on the board. That way you get some energy over here and keep all this falling asleep. It's okay. Probably already have this. You could draw this back. So if we did a cross-section of the spinal cord, what do we usually call this? Butterfly test? Just bring back the psychology experience to that. Right. So, like, this structure, this is why I like PowerPoints, because I'm drawing certain points. What's happening up here? What's this region called? Anybody remember?
Dorsal horn.
Okay. So dorsal horn. Alright. And what's coming in this dorsal horn?
Sensory neurons.
Exactly. So sensory neurons are coming in. Your dorsal root ganglion's out here, right? The cell bodies for these sensory neurons are out here. And your spinal cord is around here, right? So this is outside. So sensory neurons are coming in. They then synapse onto interneurons. Those interneurons might be multiple types, right? Might be multiple layers. Might be a little cross and things on the other side. What's down here for the cell body for your motor neurons? And then they exit out. So these are your motor neurons. And this is the ventral horn, the dorsal horn. So dorsal horn, sensory neurons coming in, ventral horn, motor neurons coming out. This is on standardized exams like your MCAT test too, these kind of pictures, and so if you're interested in how they help. Right. Has anybody taken MCAT and seen this kind of test out? Somebody on a previous class. Okay, so you should know that. What's happening in these other regions out here, and out here, and out here? And all in here. What's going on in this region? Anybody remember? Is it important? Can we just cut it away? What happens if you go in there and just cut that out of you? Does it matter? Anybody? What's going on? How does this information, when you pinch your finger out here, right, the sensory nerve comes in, and then you retract your arm, right, because you're stimulating these motor neurons for retraction, but how is it that you feel it? How do you know it? How is that sensory information getting to your brain, right? Well, these second-order neurons then go up and kind of traps up to your zenith, up to your higher centers, right? So you have tracks that run to the higher centers. And there's some tracks that, if you took the neuroanatomy course, and you might get more of it in here, is that some of these tracks are for your limbs, like your arms up here, and some of them for your legs. These are tracks that run up to your higher brain. And then there's tracks that run down, right, from the higher centers that are running in this blackboard and are running down to do what? To control, say, your motor neurons. So they're running in the plane of this blackboard, and then they go on in and they'll innervate these motor neuron cell bodies over here, the dendrites on the cell bodies, and then they fire that motor neuron so you can move your leg or move your hand, so you want to move your arm, right? So how does that thought relating to, say, activating those motor neurons in the ventral horn of your spinal cord? So these are tracks that run up and down your spinal cord. And it's important. And they actually know every little part of these tracks. They know what's running down here and what's running down here. If we look, you can go online and Wikipedia, and you can see that it's all divided up. And they know that these tracks control different parts of our body. And it's kind of interesting because some of these tracks that are going up the spinal cord carry pain information. So think of somebody that has, say, cancer pain. They have bone cancer in their legs, and they got this chronic pain. What are you going to do for a cancer patient that has chronic pain in their bone? So they have bone cancer. What would you do? What would you want if you're in chronic pain and can't, really stand it? You want medication. You want morphine. You want some drugs, right? What are those drugs going to do to you?
Make you drowsy.
You're going to be a couch potato, sitting in bed all day long, and say, oh, I don't feel pain. What happens to your life? You're not out doing anything either, right? You can't really drive, you can't do anything, you're just drugged out the whole time. So, some other ideas is to maybe get rid of those pain fibers from carrying the pain up to the brain. So if you have cancer pain in your legs, and maybe these are the pain fiber regions you're carrying pain up to your brain. So they go in and actually cut, sever that region. So in that case, you might not want those neurons to regrow, right? Because it's a treatment. You cut those tracks, so now you don't feel the pain anymore. But you're not going to feel any, maybe pinching on that part of your body down there for pain. But that's okay. You can go out and live again. You're not taking all those drugs. Now, when they were doing some of these experiments, they found out some really neat things. Well, when they went in and cut these regions, all of a sudden, depends on where they made the cut, the person couldn't breathe anymore. Because it was the descending tracks to your muscles and your ribs for your external intercostals that allow you to inflate your lungs, the internal intercostals that pull down on your ribs. So without having those controls to your muscles, what happens to your breathing? You're on a ventilator, right? So back to square one, kind of, not in pain, now you're on a ventilator. So earlier on, but they've worked out. The point I'm trying to make is it's very specific. The tracks are so specific. They know very well now which tracks are running up, which are controlling what. So they can go in and actually do surgeries and cut out very fine tracks. What was really neat, the postdoc up in Toronto, Canada, many years ago, there were graduate students that were actually working in the clinics, in the neurosurgery clinic, in the hospital, and they put electrodes inside of people while the neurosurgeons making cuts. And they would say, okay, they were stimulating tracks. And they'd say, am I still getting conduction? Did I cut that track? Or, okay, you got to stop now. We've cut so much. And it was really a neat interaction with the graduate people working on neurophysiology and the neurosurgeon doing the surgery to then, work with this patient. And it was really a fascinating time for graduate students, but also you see the mix of basic science, understanding the neurophysiology and the equipment, as well as working with the clinician that's doing the surgery. So hopefully that kind of excites you why you want to know about these things, right? So really keep you going. All right, so the peripheral nervous system, let's go through some of this. If we think about the peripheral nervous system, it's divided up into these three general groups called somatic, autonomic, and enteric. Where does the somatic come from, do you think? What did we just talk about in embryogenesis? We talked about the somites, right? The somites, these regions in your body that are in segments where your muscles are developing. And so this is the idea of somatic nervous system. They carry the motor and sensory information in that region to and from the spinal cord or to the CNS, substance if it's up higher or lower in your body. And so that's called the somatic nervous system. The autonomic, we divide up into two general classes, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and we'll get into a little bit more of that in just a minute. And then this third system called the enteric system. And that's more or less for the gastrointestinal tract, pancreas, and gallbladder, so enteric system in your body. Sometimes you might hear of this in Eastern Europe, they probably call this metasympathetic. Sometimes it's called metasympathetic. But generally, then, for this purposes here, think of it as the enteric system. Okay, so that's interesting. And what did we just do? We just drew this track over there on the board for you before. And one thing I didn't mention on that board is we consider this butterfly region called the gray matter and the outside regions around it, the white matter. And the reason is the white matter, when you take that in cross-section, it actually looks white visibly. You know, you see it as white. If you had a fresh spinal cord and you made a cut, that actually looks white. And it's mostly because of that insulation that's around those nerves. That's the myelin. The myelin insulation looks white. That's that insulation around all those tracts running up and down the spinal cord. But in the gray matter, think about the sensory neurons coming in, making a synaptic contact with the dendritic tree of that interneuron. You don't want a lot of myelination between that, right? Because you're actually having to release a transmitter. You're having to communicate to that target cell. So you don't want myelination blocking that connection, right? So you have many cell bodies in here, and you have these neurons making connections. And so without that myelination, this looks grayish, darker. So it's called the gray matter, because it doesn't have as much myelination in there. And then here's that dorsal root ganglion again that we were talking about, where your cell body is for this region. So let's think about some of these following the slides that we had here. The cell bodies for these, either in the brain or the spinal cord, that run for the skeletal muscles. How many cranial nerves do we have? 5, 6, 10, 12, 15? I'm going to harass our nurse over here.
No, I shouldn't
have
sat in front.
Okay.
I want to say
10. 12 cranial nerves. All right, so you should know your 12 cranial nerves. Just, I don't know if Dr. Debsky wants you to memorize those. Probably she does. But you should know them from having a neuroanatomy course, right? And I do remember, if you're interested in allied health, I'll even mention his name. It was Bruce Malley. He's an associate chair over in anatomy and neurobiology. My graduate student was in the basement of the EM facility one time. He was waiting to speak to Dr. Malley because he needed some help on the electron microscope. And the med school students, the first-year med students, are waiting up, lined up to ask him questions since he was in charge of gross anatomy in the neuroanatomy section. And Andy came back and told me the story. He says, boy, I went back and made sure I remembered my cranial nerves just in case I was asked, because he was just chewing out a first-year student. Says, what? You don't know there's 12 cranial nerves? Out of my office. So you really, you know, you should know there's 12 cranial nerves. And how are they numbered? From the front to the back. One in front and 12 towards the back. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you probably had that in high school. If you had a biology class, you probably identified those on the sheep brain at one time. So in the brain region, the cell bodies for, say, your facial muscles, they're not in the spinal cord. They're actually in the higher part in the brain, right? And they project out these cranial nerves to the muscles, like in your face. And so this is what's happening up in the brain. And your spinal cord, then, like for your fingers and your arms and your feet, those cell bodies exist in those ventral horns in the cross-section of your spinal cord. All right, so that's the somatic system that we just kind of talked about. And we've talked about the sensory in the somatic system. Sensory in the CNS, in the higher system in your brain, not in your spinal cord, but where are the sensory neurons, say, for I'm pinching on my face, where's the sensory neurons there? Or where are the sensory neurons to my, you know, taste on my tongue? Where's the cell bodies for those? We talked about the sensory neurons out in your, you know, for your skin. If I pinch out here my finger on the skin, those are in dorsal root ganglion. But the cell bodies for up in your facial region, right, those cell bodies are inside of your brain, right? So they don't have a dorsal root ganglion sitting out there. They're inside. So a little bit of a separation that you have to think about here. So autonomic means we don't have to think about it, right? We don't have to think about breathing in, breathing out, or that our pH is too low or too high, right? It's controlled right away. And if something scared you right away, you don't want to sit and think, should I be scared, right? You want to react very quickly. And so you have what's called this autonomic nervous system. And it's very interesting, the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And I think you probably know about the sympathetic, fight or flight, right? If you get scared, what happens to your body? Let's say, anybody remember the 350 analogy that we always say for the sympathetic? Anybody remember that? Horny analogy we give and story to try to remember this? Don't remember my corny stories, I'm hurt. Alright, so happy to you. Some people are gonna fall asleep otherwise. So you're walking in the woods, right? You're out and gonna run the Appalachian Trail this summer, like it warms up, and you heard there are black bears out there, right? And it's getting a little dark. You're trying to find your friend's cabin that's up in the hills. And it's getting a little dark. You're walking. And all of a sudden, you hear that bear that's roaring over there. Roar, right? And what are you going to do? What happens to your body right away?
Heart rate goes up.
Heart rate goes up. What else is going on?
Breathing rate.
Breathing rate's probably up, too, to match your heart rate. To do what? What's that reason why your heart rate's up? And your breathing rate's probably up.
Adrenaline.
Adrenaline, but what's the purpose
for
adrenaline?
Increase oxygen.
Deliver that oxygen to what?
Muscles.
To skeletal muscles. To do what? To either...
Fight or run,
right? So fight or flight, that's the idea. So, and why do you want to get oxygen to the skeletal muscles, just to make sure we're all bringing this together?
ATP.
To make ATP, because of electron transport chain, the end needs oxygen, right, to get most efficient for ATP. So we see that integration all from everything down to the cell level. So the cell level, to make that ATP, you're doing all these things to do what? To make that... like ATP for oxygen, get that blood there, get those muscles so they're not going to fatigue so you can run or fight, right? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Try to pull all that together when you're thinking of aspects. So fight or flight, so either you're going to fight with this bear or run from it, right? You're not interested in anything else with it, mating with it or anything like that, for example, right? So then you all of a sudden you got to your senses, right? Oh, I forgot. I have my gun with me. So you turn around and you shoot it, right? You say, oh, I shot the bear. Now I don't have to worry about it. So what do? You drag it up to your cabin. You finally see your friend's cabin up there in the hill, right? So you drag it up to the cabin. You say, I read on one of those movies that, you know, you could eat bear meat, right? So let's cut this up. I forgot to bring my food with me anyways. And your friend has a little grill up there. You put the hot wood in there. And you put the other hot wood under this little stove. And you find out, oh, I can heat up this water. And they have like a little sauna over there. So I can actually heat up this hot tub, right? So then you cook your bear steak, you're getting ready, and if you're over 21, you open your glass of wine, right? And you say, I'm going to sit in that hot tub, I'm getting the water warm from underneath, and you're in that hot tub, what are you now? Totally relaxed, right? You're getting ready to eat that bear steak, and what's going on? Salivating, stomach starting to think, oh, that's great food. And then your significant other comes up there too, right? And then she jumps in the hot tub, or he or whoever. And then you start thinking about other things, right? And so other things start going on. Blood goes to other regions of your body. That's your parasympathetic system, all right? So that's your rest and digest. Now, it's a little bit crude, but I heard this in a book. It's actually in a textbook. It says the autonomic system is to do four things. It's the four Fs. Fight, flight, and fear, right? So fight, flight, fear. And reproduction. That's what I'm going to say. But you can remember then that matches the sympathetic parasympathetic system. All right, so hopefully you can remember some of that. We'll come back to where these neurons are actually coming out of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, because it's quite interesting as well. And actually, when you think about it, think about all the problems that people have with digestion and stomach acid buildup, or you got stomach cramps, or you got GI problems, or you have diarrhea. There's a lot of money spent on the medications that work on the nervous system for your autonomic nervous system to decrease anxiety, for example, you know, being tense all the time, or helping with digestive processes. So there's a lot of pharmacology in this system, and a lot of money that's made by pharmaceutical companies directing medications that are specific to different regions in the autonomic nervous system, in the enteric nervous system as well. So here's your fight or flight response. You can imagine what this dog's going through, and heart rate's probably just going crazy. All right, and then if we think about what's happening here with this, the anatomy in the autonomic nervous system. So you do have to know this kind of anatomy. This should make some sense after we go through some more figures for you here in a minute. But think of the spinal cord, the cell body there, projecting out into the periphery now to a ganglion, a group of cells that's out inside of your body. And this is called the preganglionic axon. And when it goes to this particular neuron that's out in your body, in this ganglion, this is called a postsynaptic, because it's post from this first neuron that's coming out of your spinal cord. So the postganglionic axon. Then that neuron goes to your target. Maybe it's smooth muscle somewhere in your, maybe in your arteries for contraction. All right, and so we'll talk about that in a minute. So preganglionic, postganglionic, and we're going to talk about the types of neurotransmitters that's released here and here, and that's important as well. And that's where it's really quite important. Okay, so preganglionic cell bodies either in the spinal cord or in the central brain that then goes to another ganglion out in the body. And I know that might be a little bit mysterious right now, but let's look at some figures here in a second. All right, so for the anatomy, I mean, for the biochemistry that we just talked about, let's think about this now. This, I have a table that we're going to show you next that might help. Think about how to divide it up with sympathetic and parasympathetic. And there's the next figure I'll try to help you to memorize some of those points as well. But sympathetic, the preganglionic releases acetylcholine, it's a neurotransmitter, from the preganglionic to the postganglionic cell. And the sympathetic from the postganglionic to the target cell releases what's NE stand for? Anybody remember?
Norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine, right? So norepinephrine. And then that norepinephrine then has an action on that postsynaptic cell. It might cause contraction. It depends on the type of receptors that are over here. And you have different types of receptors that some of you might have had in a psychology class if you've taken brain and behavior. Anybody taking brain and behavior in here? Do you remember the type of receptors that were over here in the postganglionic? Alpha and beta receptors. Okay, it's alpha and beta. All right, so now let's look at the parasympathetic. Acetylcholine again on the free to the post, but on the post to the target, acetylcholine. So differences are here, right? On between the free, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and acetylcholine is over here. So that's kind of interesting to think about, that there's these differences. Let's look at this table, and this might help you as well. So this is somewhat of this pharmacology again. Divided the same way, sympathetic across the top and parasympathetic in the bottom. Acetylcholine, that's the receptors on the postsynaptic cell of that ganglion, right? So pre to post. Nicotinic means nicotine binds to those receptors. That's how you classify these type of receptors, and these are nicotinic too for the parasympathetic. So acetylcholine from the preganglionic to the postganglionic cell are nicotinic receptors. They still respond to acetylcholine. So acetylcholine will activate these receptors, but there's different subsets of these receptors that acetylcholine responds to. They name these by pharmacological definitions. Nicotine will activate a subset of those, so they're called nicotinic. The other type of acetylcholine receptors called muscarinic, because muscarin will work on those receptors. So they're all acetylcholine receptors, but they have subgroups. These are called nicotinic receptors. Nicotine that's in your cigarettes activates those. Nicotine will activate those. Now, on the target of the postsynaptic ganglion to the in-target tissue, look what's different about this. It was nicotinic over here, but now it's muscarinic on the parasympathetic. So it still releases acetylcholine, but the receptor subtype is different. They respond differently, and they have a different action. And your norepinephrine, as we mentioned up there, there's different types of receptors here, alpha and beta. And some of these can cause relaxation. Some of them can cause contraction of your smooth muscle. It depends on the which receptors are present in that smooth muscle. So what do you want on your skeletal muscles if you activate sympathetic? You might want them to allow blood to flow to them. But what do you want to blood vessels maybe in your GI tract? You don't want blood going to your GI tract, right? So you might shut blood down to your GI tract. If you're scared of that bear, you're not thinking about eating it right now, right? So you could shunt blood away and get it to your skeletal muscles. Allow those to allow blood flow to go to them. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to think about. And if you think about this, this is where the pharmacology, this is where pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money. They're trying to target specifically to these regions. So here's something for you to think about. If nicotine activates these receptors, what happens when you smoke? If you don't smoke and you first start to smoke, what happens to your heart rate? It starts to go up. It starts to go up. But these receptors are both in both ways. And if this was then going to this region and then activating my heart, right? Sympathetic speeds up your heart rate. Well, why isn't it, you know, is it activating these and then causing this to cause my heart to go up? But here's something that's a little bit confusing. Your vagal nerve that comes out your 12th, your 10th cranial nerve, the vagal nerve, next, vagal nerve, it goes to your heart and it releases acetylcholine onto your heart. And that acetylcholine that releases onto your heart from the vagal nerve, your 10th cranial nerve, is what? Nicotinic. But that actually slows down your heart rate, right? Your vagal nerve slows down your heart. It's wild, isn't it? So your vagal nerve will slow down your heart if you stimulate it. But when you start smoking a cigarette, your heart rate speeds up first, right? You're going to increase your heart rate. And actually, in your brain, you have more activation of your sympathetic nervous system in your brain when you smoke a cigarette. And it actually can cause this tract to be activated and actually increase your heart rate. So it's kind of interesting to think about. We'll come back to some of this in a little bit. So it's sometimes not just so straightforward. You have to think about the whole system. That's what I'm trying to get you to think about. All right, so let's look at this next figure, and I think this will help us bring it together. All right, so sympathetic on the left and parasympathetic on the right. How to remember this? Think of a pair for parasympathetic. Pair, cranial, sacral, a pair, right? And the sympathetic, thoracic, lumbar. Thoracic, lumbar. So parasympathetic, cranial, sacral, and you see the cranial nerves coming out, sacral nerves coming out, sympathetic, thoracic, lumbar, coming out here, going to those ganglion that we talked about, and then postsynaptic ganglion to the target tissue. Okay, interesting. Okay, let's go to this next slide. Oops, let's go back again. Think of parasympathetic again. Pair, acetylcholine, acetylcholine. Parasympathetic will help you. Pair, acetylcholine, acetylcholine. The only thing that's a little bit different is this muscarinic receptors that are on the target cells. Okay, hopefully that'll help with this a little bit and separating these out. Is there any questions on this idea, right? A parasympathetic and sympathetic, what they do, what you have to kind of remember in your brain, right, for all this. All right, so characterizing this peripheral nervous system, just kind of rehashing, sensory, or it's also called afferents, going into the central nervous system, coming in that dorsal horn, efferents, going out, like out of the ventral horn, right? So efferents, motor, cranial nerves, from the brain out to the periphery. That's what we're talking about. It's like the 12 cranial nerves, right? And then the spinal nerves out of the spinal cord going to the periphery or connecting in with the periphery. Somatic, as we mentioned, skin and muscle with the central nervous system, you know, motor neurons going out. And visceral, like these organs inside of your gallbladder or digestive system. All right. The spinal cord, we think of the brain and these different regions in the brain. And you can divide them up into many different regions. But in general, we should know these general regions in the brain. I have a picture for you coming up as well, too. The spinal cord, we know where that is, right? Down here. And then inside of your vertebrae. cerebral hemispheres. These are these regions that are on your brain, and left and right cerebral hemispheres, for example, are cerebral cortex and deep-lying structures inside of the brain. We'll talk about some of those a little bit. Basal ganglia, hippocampus, amygdala. Amygdala is this interesting region people are understanding more about, like with fear, that you might have to destroy the amygdala in mice, for example. They tend not to have any fear after that. So you wonder about people on like these crazy things like Evel Knievel, or people that do these weird stunts that have no fear. Maybe they got a damage in their amygdalas or something, right? But this is a very ancient structure in our brain, and very old in the sense of evolutionary, really. Diencephalon, this is the thalamus and the hypothalamus, and we'll, I'm sure Dr. Dubsky will talk more about this. Hypothalamus, you probably remember, if you had a physiology course, your endocrine is very important with the hypothalamus, move back to the pituitary. Midbrain, superior and inferior polygonal. Talk more about that, and I'm sure Dr. Dubsky might talk more about this later in detail. Medulla and pons. The medulla, we'll see it in the structure of the brain as you're going down from the higher centers towards the spinal cord. This is where the medulla is, in the pons region, right after this region, where it's an important area of the brain before sending information out towards the spinal cord. And the cerebellum, a part in your brain that helps you with coordination, like moving your digits, moving your fingers. So let's look at some of these structures and see about some of those in a few slides. Maybe this will help as well. If you look at in development, the neural tube that develops as an embryo and how that starts to break out into these different regions and then getting further, farther and farther with the specific types of functions that these take place, the forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain, spinal cord here going down. And then you think about these regions, like telencephalon, diencephalon, midbrain, mesencephalon, this hindbrain that separates out, and then the spinal cord. And now you can kind of get an idea of where these different structures are coming from. In some animals, they don't have a very big cerebellum, right? Like a bird, right? They have a small cerebrum. And in us, our cerebrum grows so large, it goes over much of our brain. Right? And so animals that are more complex develop more of the cerebrum, have more thought processes. And the thalamus and hypothalamus, in this basic region in the ventral part of the brain and up to the spinal cord, is consistent in its anatomy and structure from a lizard, from a fish to a bird to us, and how these different regions and what they take place and what their function is. So let's look at a few pictures. In cross-section, here's that cross-section we drew in the back of the board. Dorsal horn, ventral root. Here's this dorsal root ganglion that's probably, right here's this dorsal root ganglion. You can see the cell bodies up there. All right. And she wants you to know that there's 31 pairs of spinal nerves outside your spinal cord. So 31 pairs as they come out and go to different regions in our body, or segments of our body. Okay. Some of the communication from the periphery to the CNS, and then a motor output. This is your behavior, right? This is how you behave. How do you know a behavior is your action to something, right? Your reaction to something. So if something pinches you, then you pull your arm away. So what's the connection involved in that? And you can do this even in a decerebrate animal, like a cat that you've severed the spinal cord with. If you burn that cat's foot, it's going to pick it up. It doesn't have to have a higher thought process to do that. Quite amazing. And it's from these connections within the spinal cord where this happens. So in this case, this kind of scenario is with understanding how your muscles function in proprioceptors. So in your muscles, you have these sensory neurons that detect the muscle stretch in the muscle spindle. But you could think of this as skin if you want to, and you can think of a sensory nerve coming in from pain or touch. But in this particular one, this is quite interesting because this is a monosynaptic type of reflex. So this idea is to stretch. If you stretch this muscle, this then sends an input into the dorsal horn and goes directly to the motor neuron, the dendrites in the motor neuron, and that motor neuron fires. Where is this reflex common? Did a doctor ever ask you to And did they ever test your reflexes? You cross your legs and he hits you under the patella, under your kneecap, right? And you kick out. This is this monosynaptic reflex. Because when they hit there, they're hitting on that tendon, stretches that muscle, and you kick your leg out. And it's so fast, right? So this is what's referred to as monosynaptic reflex because of the very fastness of this, and you kick your leg. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Now, many others then would have multiple, say, inner neurons to this communication. If you take cross-sections of the spinal cord, you could pretty much guess where that cross-section is. If you're in med school or maybe in nursing school, and depends on PA school, and you're taking a neuroanatomy course, they're going to maybe even just throw up a cross-section of a spinal cord, and you have to say where that is in the spinal cord. And you'll be able to do that because you know what's going in that spinal cord in that region and what's coming out. What do you think is going to happen if we take a cross-section of a spinal cord up above by our arms, where our arms, all those nerves from our arms are coming in and all those motor neurons are going out? What do you think would be different from a region, say, mid-thorax? Exactly. All the sensory nerves coming in, the dorsal horn is going to be enlarged, and the ventral horn is going to be enlarged because of all the motor neurons that go out to control all these muscles out here, right? So this is what you would see. You'll see an enlarged ventral horn and enlarged dorsal horn. And as you go into the thorax, they decrease. But what's interesting in the thoracic lumbar region, you got this little point that comes out. Look at that little point. See that little point right there? And that's a key index. What actually is in that little point? What did we just kind of cover? What comes out of the thoracic lumbar region? What kind of nerves come out of the thoracic lumbar region?
Your heart, your lungs, your vagus.
That's right. The vagal is the cranial, but you're right on the right track. The sympathetic system. Remember, that's the thoracic lumbar. The cell bodies for those preganglionic neurons that come out, they are right here in that region. So the thoracic lumbar, sympathetic preganglionic neurons, the cell bodies are right here. So if you got a cross section, you saw that right away, thoracic lumbar, right? You got it now. So that's the thoracic lumbar region. That's the cell bodies that would be there, and those sensory, those sympathetic neurons would come out and then go out into the target of postsynaptic ganglion. And then you're down in the lumbar region. What's happening down here? As you get down towards the sacral region, the very end, look how enlarged this is again. Why? All those neurons going out for your legs, right? And then all the sensory neurons coming in, too. Look how enlarged this is. Very enlarged. So you get the idea that you could tell where the cross sections are in general. And so they have certain names, and you can make sure you remember this, lumbar sacral enlargement, right? Lumbar sacral enlargement. Intermediate cell column, and then the cervical enlargement for the arms. We've talked about it in the section that we did up at the top, over there on the other board. Remember these white area in here? Dorsal columns, ventral columns, intermediate columns. Okay? So dorsal columns running up, sending information up to the brain, and lateral columns and ventral columns, the information's coming down or sending up into the brain also. So dorsal columns primarily has sensory neurons. And those sensory neurons are from your arms and your legs. And they're sending it up to the higher center so you know where your limbs are and where you've got pinched or not. The ventral columns on the bottom, these ventral columns down here, right? These ventral columns. They have these motor controls for posture control. Like, you have to activate those motor neurons, right? So they're relaying information. And as we mentioned, some of these neurons have asensory coming up to higher centers, like pain and thermal sensation. Like we mentioned, cutting those neurons for reducing pain, like chronic pain. But the problem is, you also got tracks running next to those for motor neurons that can control skeletal muscles, so you don't want to cut those if you were going to do some kind of surgery and such the nature. The lateral columns on the sides, higher levels to other regions, and then more control on motor neurons and inner neurons in the spinal cord for coordination and other functions. Okay, so let's see what time it is here. I probably got behind because I was going tangents. What time do we get out of here?
45.
120. Okay, so go quickly. Okay, so cerebral cortex. Think about that part of their brain. That's the big enlargement on our brain, cerebral cortex. Here's your ventral view of your brain. Here's your spinal cord. This cauliflower-looking thing, that's the cerebellum, right? The coordination that I mentioned, like for your fingers and walking, coordination aspects. So cerebrum from higher thought processes, and you can see some of the cranial nerves coming off here. Here's the optic going off to your eyes, optic nerve, for example. All right, but the cerebral cortex is outer layer, gray matter, lots of cells interconnecting, right? And important for analyzing your sensory information and also your thought processes, right? How you think. So higher animals have more of this cerebrum. And you can think about a long time ago, they thought there was this kind of general, you know, feeling of the head and that you could tell a person's thought processes and how smart they were by bumps in their head. And now that's all, you know, kind of poo-pooed. But the idea was kind of interesting because that's where we are now by knowing different regions in the brain and these specific locations by injuries or surgeries that have been done or removing a tumor from some area and somebody can't speak anymore, for example. So they've figured out very much about the brain, these different regions. So you know that speech is in a certain area. Sensory for saying, I feel my toe, then that's in this part of the brain up there. Or I want to move my foot. That motor command starts in the motor cortex part of your brain. And that's where you'll initiate that action. So the cerebrum and different parts of the brain, the cerebellum, as we mentioned, coordination's down here, and then the spinal cord. All right. And here's, in case we were at that point before and we didn't really know where the pons was, you can see the pons right before the spinal cord. Here's medulla oblongata. This is where it's coming out of your skull, and then right here is where the spinal cord will then exist as it exits the skull. So different regions, we probably need to know some of these different regions, and probably Dr. Debs is going to go into some of these in more detail about what they do. But the cerebrum itself is divided up, frontal cortex, parietal cortex, occipital cortex in the back, occipital, and temporal cortex in the side, and cerebrum over here, brainstem. And these regions have general functions. Occipital cortex, visual, parietal cortex, association, and we'll maybe talk more about that, like with your motor and sensory command, and frontal cortex, thought processes. Right? The grooves inside in the brain, when you look at it, those little grooves, they're called sulci, and the gyri are the elevated regions, the ridges. And so they can actually look at brains and pretty much tell you some aspects of those. Ones that don't have those little ridges or grooves, there's usually some disorder with those. But why do you think that the brain does that? Makes those little grooves and
bumps.
Yes, it increases the surface area tremendously, right? For putting in more neurons into that volume. Because in the neurons or in the brain, it's layered with layers of neurons doing different function. So if you can take those layers, instead of just having it smooth across like that, if you can have those layers go like that, then you can have more integrating process in keeping those layers functioning together. Okay, so there's some definitions that they use. This region is easily characterized in the brain, called the central sulcus, and anything in front of it they call precentral gyrus, and anything behind it, postcentral gyrus, and it's just a way to classify then regions of the brain by these very prominent grooves, for example, are sulci that are in the brain. Okay, frontal lobes. Let's think about what's happening up there in the frontal lobe. A lot of actions are going on, like spontaneity, impulse control, social behavior. And if you remember, maybe you've heard about lobotomies. And, you know, it was really a very controversial Nobel Prize that was given to this person. But he went around with an ice pick, and actually they would go up through the top of your eyeball right up there and go up there and actually cut these regions and cut out that part of the front of the brain, so this frontal brain. And there's actually an article that you can just look it up and say lobotomies, and it'll probably tell you about the history of this guy. So your eye's right here, and they go up right up there and actually sever across this region.
And they would do this for very people that had criminal behavior, that were very socially misfits in the sense of they couldn't control them. And this would basically make them a couch potato afterwards, and they couldn't really function well. And so this was a part probably very bad in neuroscience history, but it did open up some understandings from it. A lot of these people ended up with epilepsy later on, because when you make those large damages to the brain, this causes scar tissue, and there's epileptic seizures that exist after these kind of damage to the tissue. But that's the prefrontal cortex, and that probably controlled some of that spontaneity or the impulse control in that region. The parietal lobes, these sides on the side of our head, and your skull is named by these regions as well, the plates in your skull, the different regions. They have these similar names, like the occipital plate, the parietal plate there. This region is has a lot to do with perception, the sensory perception, and integrates the sensory input with the visual system, too, to control. Like, I want to go pick up, you know, this object, how do you do that? You have to have control to do that, right? So that perception for your sensory, and then knowing that you're initiating that command correctly. And this is really interesting. If anybody's ever read the book by Oliver Sacks, I really encourage you to get, you know, do something kind of fun reading. Oliver Sacks is this neurologist that wrote a number of books, but there's a book that The Man That Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And it's a really kind of fun read for the general public. And it's basically problems in association, in this region of association, of not being able to understand the sensory input and how to perceive that. So he would go and he sees his wife over there, or he sees his hat on the wall, and his wife sitting next to him in his room, and he's pulling on his wife's hair. And Oliver Sacks asks him, "What are you doing?" "I'm trying to get my hat. I see my hat over there." But he's pulling on his wife's hair over here, right? Maybe it was just a, you know, was faking it. Who knows? No, I'm joking. But it was a real problem. This association problem with sensory input and what's reality. But pick up that book. It's pretty neat. The Man That Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks, a neurologist that wrote these neat stories. Occipital lobes, like I mentioned, for visual perception in the back here of your brain. So when you have a head injury, for example, or you get your test back and you say, "Oh, I'm so upset to go hit your head in the wall," right? Don't do that. But you hit your head in the wall, what's going to happen? Your brain's going to go forward and backward, and what's it going to do? Hit the skull, right? It's going to bruise this area. So after a head injury, for example, you might have visual problems. That's why if you hit your head, you fall so hard, the doc says, in a couple days, 2 or 3 days, if you have any visual problems, let me know, come on back. Because maybe you bruise the brain here, and you might have a little hematoma develop. Because this will mess up your visual system if you have damage back here, for example. All right. Temporal lobes, and this is what we were mentioning with organization of sensory input and being able to say things that you want. Say, "I see something red, but I can't say it. But I know it's red." I can maybe write it out red, but I can't say it's red, right? Or it might be the other way. You could say it's red, but you can't write it's red. Weird things like this, right? And so these are these regions, the temporal lobe with association that we've mentioned about inputting that sensory input and being able to perceive it and know what it really means. So some of these, you know, you've probably heard of right brain, left brain. And they do know that people with right hand versus left-handers, generally, there's some different regions in how the brain functions in this region. Right side regions usually impair the nonverbal, such as music or drawings, right, for a right-handed person. So music and drawings on the right side. And the left side region might be with words, more with words. But you can't say, like I mentioned, you know, red, for example, even though you see that it's red, or you could write that it's red. So it's interesting, this is where these differences of left and right brain occur, but with association. All right, I don't want to go over my time limit. So these slides I just put on your PowerPoint for your purposes. I don't think Dr. Debs is going to test you on those now. Maybe she will later. Just so you could see the cranial nerves. And I did it for different animals. Like this is a fish here, and you can see the frogs, birds, humans. These different regions of the brain, like we were talking about, that they're very similar from lower animals to higher animals. Okay, I'll put all that podcast and everything on